Welcome to Season 13 of the Art of Teaching podcast. My name's Matthew Green, and I'm so glad that you joined me today. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of this land on which I'm recording, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I acknowledge the stories, traditions, and living cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on this land. Today I have the privilege of sharing a recent conversation that I had with Matthew Bentley. He's the head of teaching and learning at Shaw, a school where I did my first casual day. Matthew has a demonstrated history of working in the education sector. He is skilled in professional development, secondary education, assessment, curriculum, and educational consulting. In this conversation, we talked about the importance of marginal gains over time, the privilege of our profession, and new models of professional learning. I hope that you get as much out of this wide-ranging conversation as I did. Please enjoy. Matthew Bentley, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. Where are you phoning in from?
Thanks, Matt. I'm phoning in from Shaw School at North Sydney.
Lovely. So you are you there after hours? Do you live there? What's your go? Because it is well and truly past school closing time.
Well, actually, I'm calling in tonight from home, which is not too far away.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a part of the boarding community at the moment, even though the school does have some boarders as part of the school community.
And as we mentioned before I hit record, I really have a soft spot for Shaw. It was the first place that I did my casual day, my first casual day, and I remember getting a phone call, and I said to the lady on reception, are you sure you've got the right number? Because I was not expecting a phone call. But this was a number of years ago, but it's such a wonderful institution with such a rich history. And I just remember feeling so welcomed by everyone there. So I don't know who to pass on my gratitude to, but thanks.
Not at all. Like, it still is a very great place to work and a special place. In fact, I've just come back to Shaw at the beginning of term four last year as head of teaching and learning, and I actually used to work at the school 15 years ago, so I've come back after a hiatus.
Right.
And loving being part of the school community again.
I love that. And Matthew, we'll get into that in a little bit, just about your history in education, and I would love to hear about your transition back into Shaw. That sounds wonderful. But quite possibly the most important question for our conversation: what's your coffee order when I can finally jet over the bridge and buy you a coffee?
I'm pretty straightforward, just a flat white.
Nice, same.
In the mornings, and then if I'm feeling, usually I'm a one coffee a day kind of person,
yeah.
But if I need one after lunch, I'll just grab a Piccolo or an espresso.
Fantastic. Is that just to get you to 3 o'clock?
Just to kick me through if I'm having a particularly busy day.
Is there a book that you have read recently that's caused you to stop and reconsider a few things in your life?
Yeah, actually, over the summer break, I did quite a bit of reading.
Right.
Probably for me, I've really enjoyed Adam Grant's Hidden Potential.
Love that.
It was little bit remindful of James Clear's Atomic Habits. And
yes,
I've kind of extrapolated some of those ideas for what we're doing at Shaw at the moment, just looking at that sort of incremental improvement, that idea of the aggregation of marginal gains over time in terms of teaching staff, just looking at one thing that they're doing in the class and trying to do it a little bit better over a period of time.
Fantastic. And we'll get into some of the work that you do with Shaw, but I understand we have a mutual friend in Dr. Simon Breakspear.
We do. Yeah, Simon's a really impressive educator, and
sure
I've been fortunate at Shaw. We're doing some work with Simon and his colleague, Professor Tony Lachlan at the University of New South Wales, where basically we're doing some teaching sprints. So it's a new program, and we've just actually officially launched it this year. I know there was some work that was undertaken before I arrived, and basically the essence of it is that we realized we had a bit of a gap for our teachers who had been teaching at the school a while. We had a really good mentoring program for all new staff, but not as much on offer for staff who'd been there for a while. So the professional learning committee and some key people at the school have developed some teaching sprints with some input from Simon and also from Tony. So just a couple of sessions in and loving it.
So so am I right in saying that your teaching sprint is around teacher professional learning, not necessarily student outcomes, which obviously drives student outcomes when you've got professionals at working at their best? But did you chose to focus on professional practice?
Yeah, very much. I think the two are kind of inextricably connected, or two sides of the same coin, if you like. But yes, we definitely have focused on a range of topics like Socratic circles or kind of worked examples, which is more of a scaffolding-based approach, or sort of retrieval practices, questioning techniques. There's six or seven kind of areas where staff have put up their hands really to lead some strategies that people can apply over a period of time. So the sprint kind of model runs for about a term.
Yeah.
And basically some research, some evidence, people put it into practice, they pop into in and out of one another's classrooms and give some feedback, and hopefully it has some impact for our students.
Yeah, I've had the privilege of using Dr. Simon Breakspear's teaching sprints for in a number of different schools and a number of very different schools in terms of the educational context. And the impact is really noticeable. And I think I know in our job, and I'm sure you agree, there is just so much happening. There's so many things going on. I had a list of things that I needed to get done today, and now I just have a larger list of things that need to get done. Just to be able to focus on some really explicit, really important aspects, whether it be professional learning or student outcomes, has really made a difference, I think, in the way that we did things, because you strip away everything else and you just look at that one thing or those couple of things that you need to look at. Would you agree, like, having that focus is really important, and even just putting it down on a piece of paper is beneficial?
Incredibly important. And I think one of the things that I'm really enjoying about the teaching sprints is it's kind of low investment, high impact, I'd call it.
Absolutely.
So teachers don't have to do, because, you know, we're all busy teaching lots of classes. So there's not a significant amount of preparation. There is some kind of reading and sort of prep, but basically it's about focusing on what happens in the classroom in real time and applying that and getting some feedback to see what sort of impact it has on improving student learning outcomes.
And I really want to, Matthew, I really want to unpack that a little later, because there's so much in that, and I'm fascinated to learn about some of the great work that you're doing at Shaw in that space. But just out of interest, is there something that you've changed your mind about? It could be personally, it could be professionally, it could be any of those things. Anything that you thought, not necessarily that you were wrong, but you've just sort of changed your approach to that somewhat?
Yeah, definitely. I think early in my career, I was really fixated on being a content expert and being really good. I teach English, at being really good at that and having that deep knowledge. And that is really, really important. But for me, I guess I had a bit of a watershed moment or a catalyst when I went to Melbourne a long time ago. I went to Bialik College and went to a Project Zero conference and heard David Perkins and some other people talk about pedagogy and about, you know, how you engage students with their learning and focusing on thinking and the importance that that has. And for me, that has been a bit of a lifelong love, I guess, now, in terms of thinking of ways to how can I really make sure that students are engaged in the classroom? Because even if I know everything, if I can't connect with the kids, if I can't find ways to engage them, then it's not going to have much impact on their learning. So for me, pedagogy, that shift, I guess, in terms of both are important, but realizing the importance of pedagogy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And for me, it was when, I mean, there's so many things I've changed my mind about. But for me, teaching just got a bit more personal when I kissed my daughter goodbye and she went into kindergarten last year. And it has always been something which I think we need to talk about more, which is the privilege of our profession, that people entrust us every day to look after their children and bring them back safely and bring them back into well-rounded citizens. I think that is a privilege which is really hard to put into words. But for me, when I sort of, like I said, kissed her goodbye on her first day of kindergarten last year, I just felt this new sense of ownership for what we get to do, because she's now, I have the privilege of working for the department, and she's now kind of in the system. And I always think to myself every day since that, I don't always have great lessons, but I always think, would I be happy for my child to sit through this lesson? And if the answer is no, then something needs to change. But it just became that extra bit more personal for me when I became a parent. It's amazing for me how that really changed.
Yeah, I think wearing a parent hat is really important. If you can wear it. I remember I've been involved in HSC marking over the years, and I remember someone quite experienced said to me, mark the script just as though it were your own child's. Not in the sense of, you know, being biased towards it, but having that much kind of attention and importance towards it. And it's kind of stayed with me because I think, it does matter.
And I always think about that. And obviously not everyone that's listening to this will be parents, but we are brothers or sisters or aunties or uncles. And I think for me, it's just a reminder just how precious it is to get to interact with young people every day. I was just wondering, is there something in your life, and this is another personal question that I promise we will get to your work in education, is there something in your life that you feel like you are currently under-investing in?
Well, I think the last couple of years I've made a determined effort to invest more in my well-being.
Yeah, great.
I think all of the focus on well-being for our students, we recognise that and understand how important it is. And I think equally so for teachers, that we need to make sure that we invest in keeping a balance, because we actually are more effective if we, if we're rested, if we take some time to switch off and recharge, whether that's a weekend. I attended a really good presentation by Dr. Adam Fraser, and he talked about making a daily habit, making a weekly habit, and making a monthly habit. So as a result of that, I took up golf. That's my weekly one. I'm not sure my wife's thrilled about it. No, she actually is okay about it with that. But having those kinds of things in your life, I think, kind of gives you a better balance and makes you more effective.
And can I ask, what is your what's a daily habit that you've taken up, and also what's a monthly habit?
A daily habit. I like to have a little bit of quiet time just to start the day. So I usually try and give myself a little bit of time to stop and relax. The other thing I like to do in a daily habit, sounds pretty trivial, but it's just grab my coffee on the way to work, or when I get to work, just stop, go down, have a proper coffee. I feel like I've had my little moment that's really important to me, and away I go. So probably the coffee thing for me is a nice daily habit.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to do something similarly, and I'm a huge fan of Dr. Adam Fraser. And once again, we were talking before we hit record just about the incredible generosity of our profession, and he is one such example. And his work, I've had the privilege of speaking to him a couple of times for the podcast, and his work around the third space has been truly transformative. And I do this most days. In fact, I did it before I walked through the door today, and it's just, for those people that are not aware, I'll put the links in the show notes. It's about these transitional spaces between home and work. And I stood out the front of my house today, and I've had a day, and I would prefer to have come home and slept, to be honest. But I stood outside the front of my door, and I was like, okay, how do I want to, and how do I need to show up for those that I love more than anything today? And it was just 10 seconds. And I knew that as soon as I opened that door, I would get a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old running at me. I'd get a wife that wanted to talk to me about her day. And so I think it's just being conscious about how we want to show up has been really important. I've thanked him a number of times for that. But for those that aren't familiar with his work, I would highly, highly, highly recommend it. Matthew, I did want to talk a little bit about your career in education. So what was your upbringing like? And also, what are you most grateful for from your parents or your family?
Yeah, look, I'm a person who likes to try lots of different things. I grew up in country New South Wales in Narrabri, in a sort of small town. And that was my kind of upbringing. Didn't come from a home that had lots of books. Maybe a bit ironic, I ended up being an English teacher. And I'm pretty passionate about being an English teacher, which is great. So my journey kind of started there and then went to Newcastle to do some study and then basically started my teaching career in Sydney. And I've worked across all sectors. So I started in the government sector, a few years in the Catholic systemic sector, and quite a bit of my career in the independent sector. So for me, I guess I've been really interested in learning new things. One of the things I guess I've really thanked my parents for is just having a bit of old-fashioned grit and determination and tenacity. I kind of, you know, I think my parents always instilled that in me. Growing up in a country town, often that was centered around sport and other aspects of life. But I think really having that sense of finishing things has been really formative for me.
Yeah. Does it make sense when you turn around and look back? I heard somewhere that it's really difficult to kind of join the dots looking forward, but when you turn around and look over your shoulder, it kind of makes sense. Do you feel like that? Do you feel like this this pathway that you've taken through different sectors and through working in different schools, and do you feel like it has served to get you where you are today?
Yeah, I do very much. And I kind of have felt that it's been a bit of a privilege to work in lots of different kinds of settings and contexts, because you learn a lot more along the way. And I guess as teachers, we see students learn a great deal in their journeys. And I've kind of felt that that's been the same for me, that each time I kind of go somewhere or start a new role, that it can be challenging at first, but by the end of it, you mature and grow, and it keeps it fresh and interesting for me.
Yeah. I like I said, I couldn't agree more in it. I think the older that I get, I'm still young, but the older they get and the older that I feel, I start to, I guess, see patterns in my life looking back. And I think at the times that I was in jobs that were particularly hard, or the schools that were particularly challenging, or the bosses that were particularly challenging, I feel like at the time it was really difficult, but looking back, I wouldn't change it for the world, because I feel like you learn so much from some of those challenges. Would you agree with that?
Totally. And I think, what do they say, sort of learning comes at the point of resistance or challenge. And I think that's true. I think that's where you really grow and develop. And we, you know, practice that with our students in terms of, you know, you don't want to make it too comfortable for them. You don't want to make it too difficult. It's that kind of, what is it, proximal flow or whatever, in that space. And that's the kind of sweet spot, I think, to be in if you can, but you kind of move in and out of it, I think, sometimes.
And do you think that teacher professional learning needs to kind of follow that model as well, that idea that you mentioned before, that the zone of proximal development, how you kind of you scaffold and you scaffold and you scaffold, then you slowly remove and you increase challenge? And what have you learned kind of in that teacher professional learning space about how we about what effective programs look like?
I think quite a bit. I've done quite a bit of research over the years in the teacher PD space. Yeah. And I think all the things like saying the research tells us that it needs to be embedded, it needs to be collaborative, it needs to incorporate you know, experts or mentors. It needs to be sustained. It needs to be meaningful. All of those kinds of elements that make a difference to teacher. That's how you make a difference to teacher practice, I think. In terms of, and it needs to be based on classroom. It can't be kind of divorced or too abstract. Because I think people don't see the meaning of it. They're disconnected from it. And sometimes just don't have the time as well, if it becomes too abstracted.
I always find it fascinating that we differentiate for the students in our class, but we don't really do that for professional learning. Like we sort of forget that we're just old kids that have different professional needs. And so like, I don't know if you have anything to contribute to that, but yeah, it does strike me that we seem to think that a one size fits all approach is applicable to professional learning, but that's clearly not the case, is it? We all have different professional needs and yeah.
Very much. I think it's sort of different courses for different horses. And at Shore, we've launched the STEP program with, I mentioned perhaps a little bit earlier, with Dr. Simon Breakspear and Tony Lachlan. And that really gives teachers lots of choice in terms of, we've got 6 or 7 areas that staff can look at, whether it's Socratic circles, which is a discussion-based practice, worked examples, which is kind of more scaffolding, questioning techniques. I think that kind of model where teachers can have some voice and choice, where it's aligned with what's happening in the classroom, where it's developed from experts from within the school with some external kind of input, that internal-external kind of marriage, if you like. For me, that kind of model of PD makes a lot of sense. And is quite meaningful.
Would you mind, Matthew, sharing about sort of how you've created those conditions for that? Because I could imagine that this collaboration and sharing, while it's really, really important, I could imagine for some people that would be quite confronting to put their hand up and say, I need some help with this. But talk to me a little bit about how you've created at Shore those conditions for that culture around professional learning.
Yeah, well, I think it's been a long gestation period. I've been at the school for about 6 months. And then in the 12 or kind of 18 months prior to that, there was a group that was created that looked at what kind of PD are we offering for teaching staff at the school. And there was a really good program that was in place for new staff. And it didn't matter whether you're a classroom teacher or a member of the executive, everybody did it. Everybody had a mentor where they went into different classrooms, the mentors went into their classrooms, they looked at colleagues outside their subject areas, and that was terrific. But then there was this gap for what happens to teachers who are kind of been at the school for a while and want to continue to improve their program. So through that kind of identification of the gap, collectively, the school identified a range of areas and some people put their hands up basically to lead some PD in particular areas that we feel is relevant to the context of the school. And I think that's the other thing I didn't mention earlier, that I think really high quality PD is always context specific. So what works at one school may not necessarily work at another school. And it's about kind of you know, the grassroots ground up approach, I think, is the best way to kind of leverage it.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Amy Edmondson, and she talked about psychological safety and the importance of people feeling like they can take risks regardless of where they are in the organization. And that sounds like you've worked really hard at Shore about creating that culture where a new teacher can demonstrate practice to a more seasoned professional, and also a executive can ask for help from someone who may have been teaching a lot less than they have. Is that the case? What are these discussions like at some of your professional learning sessions? It sounds like there'd be a real buzz in the air.
Yeah, I think it's kind of about being open, being transparent, and creating an environment where it's non-judgmental, where it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to try something that may work or may not work, and it's all about sort of being better working together, which is really our kind of school theme this year. We're focusing on being better together, basically. Yeah. That idea of collective teacher efficacy that Hattie kind of has done a lot of research into. Yeah. And that coupled, I guess, a little bit with Amy Edmondson's kind of that top right quadrant or whatever about being open, being direct, but also being supportive in helping one another grow and develop. Yeah. So we've sort of developed a bit of a pairs approach where, we've got leaders, but then they team up with someone else and basically have those sort of open conversations, but also feedback to one another about aspects of the classroom practice.
Yeah, I love that. I had the privilege at a number of actually probably a year ago now interviewing Professor Vivian Robinson, and she talked a lot about that, about the difference between change and improvement. And I think I'm sure it's similar in your sector as well. Like, there's a lot of things changing all the time. There's new programs, there's new this, there's new that, there's different types of pressure, but actually taking some time and saying, okay, like, how do I know my assumption is correct in this particular area? And how are we going to improve this? Because we don't want to throw out a whole, we don't want to be reactive, but we want to take our time and move progressively through these problems. I mean, as a professional learning community at Shore, how do you begin to identify some of those areas of growth or areas of need in professional learning? Because I'm sure, as in any system, there would be a lot of things that you could focus on.
Yeah, I guess research and evidence has been the way that we've approached it. So, you know, as a collective community, we've identified a range of areas that we have felt that would assist the boys in their learning.
Yeah.
But we also wanted to make sure it wasn't just a gut feeling that they needed. So we kind of brainstormed a range of areas, but they needed to be evidence-based as well. So for each of the teaching sprints, they really start with a little bit of pre-reading about what's the evidence tell us.
Right.
In that space. So it's not just a gut feeling or a hunch or change for the sake of change, but it's that idea of kind of incremental improvement, which is one of those key ideas from James Clear's book that really appealed to me in terms of just being a little bit better. But if you're a little bit better over a longer period of time, it actually has a pretty significant, or what is it, the aggregation of marginal gains. Yeah. It has a big impact on how much we can support and improve our students' learning.
Yeah, absolutely. And Matthew, I was wondering, was there a teacher that made a real difference in your life, and why?
Yeah, definitely. I think when I was in year four, I had a teacher named Mr. Cooper. Mr. Cooper, and I had him again in year six. And it was pretty rare to have a male teacher, I guess, back in those days, so in primary school. So that was a really great role model. But he definitely had a lot of applied learning. I remember that in year four, we basically put on a puppet show, and he organized everything from someone brought in an old wardrobe. I don't know where he got it from, but he cut it out. Then we made curtains. We made the puppets. We developed our own script, and it just kind of really resonated with me. And the funny thing with that story was long after I'd become a teacher, I was up around Hornsby Way at the pub, and then I bumped into this person who I remembered, and it was him some like 20-odd years later. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's 2 degrees of separation, I think, not six.
It's really wonderful, and I wish people could actually watch this video, because I love the reactions of people when I ask them about their favorite teacher. And just to see you light up after all of these years is really wonderful. And I think there's a couple of things from your story which I find really interesting. The first is, most people when I ask them that question talk about a teacher either in year three or year four, which I find fascinating. I don't know if that is a particularly formative time. Well, I know it is, but I don't know why. There's so many fond memories from that period in people's lives. But also, no one has ever talked about the content that they learned. My teacher, Mrs. Taylor Jones, who I had the privilege of interviewing for the podcast, was my year four teacher. And I don't remember what she taught me. I teach year four at the moment. And there's got to be some fractions in there. There would have been something to do with measurement and probably a narrative. But that's not what people remember. They remember how they felt when they were in their class. And would you mind maybe unpacking that a little bit? How did you feel when you're in this teacher's class? And what is it that he did that was so memorable? Because I'm sure he did that for every student. And especially as you felt you weren't the only one, but for some reason you probably felt like the most important student in that whole class. So what did he do?
I think there were lots of things. He was warm. He was affirming. He was always really genuinely interested in you as a learner, I thought, and as a person. I did get my pen license pretty early back in those days, which was surprised me a bit, but it was a good thing. I don't know if they still do pen
licenses. They do. I've actually got to laminate some for my team. Thank you for reminding me. So was it that feeling of feeling heard and valued and known? It wasn't about the content, surely.
No, not the content. He made the content pretty interesting and engaging, though, and thought about kind of a great ways to learn. But, yeah, he always turned up, was very supportive of people, very understanding of people, and pretty passionate about teaching too. You know, as you say, I might not similarly remember the topics, but I know his sort of disposition.
You remember the cupboard, don't you?
Yeah, the cupboard and just the attitude towards the learning was great.
I love that. Love that. That's really wonderful. And a teaching truly is that profession that creates all other professions. And to hear people many years later talk about their fond memories of their teachers is wonderful. So Matthew, how did you or tell me about sort of your move into boys' education? Why is it a space that you feel so passionate about?
Yeah, I started off, I had a couple of years in a few co-ed schools.
Yeah.
And then actually, as it happens, a job came up at Shore.
Oh.
And and so that was my first kind of foray into boys' ed. What appealed to me was that a number of things, I guess it was a good fit. One of the things I liked about the school was the roundedness, that you were a classroom teacher. You also did a lot of co-curricular. I get involved in debating and public speaking and those kinds of activities, but also a bit of sports coaching. Over the years, I've coached basketball and cricket and a few other bits and pieces in between. And the other piece that really appealed to me was the curriculum. Being an English teacher, I felt that the kinds of offerings and the books that the boys that were on offer really engaged the boys.
Yeah.
And some of the other places that I'd worked at, I didn't always think that they met the interests of the full range of learners within the class.
Yeah. And why, what is it that you love in particular about English education? My undergraduate was in English and it was hugely transformative, but what is it that make it, why are you so passionate about English education?
Yeah, okay.
For me, question.
I tell it to the students all the time, because most books are really about aspects of the human condition, whether it's Shakespeare or whether it's a contemporary novel. And I think that it teaches us to be a bit more human in terms of what's important in life and what kinds of stories we can learn about from others. And I think through learning about a really diverse range of stories from others, it makes us more compassionate and intelligent human beings.
Mm, yeah, I couldn't agree more, Matthew. And it's really I love English. As I said, as my undergraduate, and I think my undergraduate degree firstly taught me to read widely, and also it taught me how to think. And I think it's a really powerful skill. So being a school leader, What are some of the things that you love about the role, and also what are some of the challenges? I know that when I first stepped into a leadership role a number of years ago, I had no idea what I was doing. I thought I was fooling everyone, but I really didn't understand what leadership was. But what is it? What are some of the things that you love about being a school leader? And what are some of those challenges?
One of the things I really love is the capacity to work with a wide range of people. And to really empower people and help people grow and develop. A bit, it's the same in some ways as a classroom teacher, that you've got a group of learners in front of you, you're working with a group of colleagues, and you have a little bit more leverage, I think, in leadership sometimes to enable some of those ideas that you have. So I really like that aspect about leadership. It's interesting, I think, in my very early days, before I was a leader, had this kind of notion that, like a lot of young people that or students, that somehow you'll just tell people what to do and they'll do it. And then, of course, life doesn't work like that, nor does leadership. So you kind of, I think, learn the way to facilitate and enable people to grow and develop. And for me, that's an aspect that I genuinely find really rewarding about leadership, and particularly teaching and learning, because teaching and learning is all about that.
I mean, as you sort of gaze throughout history, there are a number of leaders that were at a positive and a negative influence for various reasons. How do you define the term leadership, and what are some of those kind of essential qualities from your point of view?
Well, there's so many different types of leadership. I think since COVID, we've talked a lot about adaptive leadership and being agile and being able to, you know, pivot and all of those kinds of cliches that have kind of developed in that space. Distributed leadership, I think that, empowering people within a team and giving people some agency and autonomy to help grow and develop is important. For me, and I think the notion of being a servant leader is also really important. The values based approach to leadership is something that really resonates with me.
Yeah, and where does sort of your and I love hearing people's varied definitions of leadership. I think it's really interesting. But where do some of your sort of examples of great leaders come from?
Yeah, it's, in terms of examples, I think they come from people that I've worked with in the past. I think I've spent a fair bit of time reading a lot of educational leadership books now, so learning about those models. But for me, I kind of think back to people I either am currently working with or people who I've previously working with and thought, okay, yeah, they're really the embodiment of that. They do that really well in terms of making people feel included and giving people some choices, or allowing people to fail sometimes, rather than, you know, that old school approach, which was much more directional kind of leadership, that top-down kind of approach. I think that kind of leadership has kind of dissolved over time.
Yeah. And is there a, this feels like a job interview, it definitely is, but are there any areas in your leadership that you feel are strengths? And also, are there any areas that you feel like you are continuing to grow in?
Yeah, I feel that I'm generally pretty good with working with people. I think I'm a good listener. A few people have given me that feedback, which is great. I think one thing I could be better at is schools are really busy places, and sometimes I can ponder a bit too long on things, and I'm still working at sort of being better with my diary in terms of locking things in and sticking to that, the time that I've got allocated, and not making it something that's bigger than Ben-Hur.
Yeah, I do that. I stew on things and I make things bigger than they need to be, and it really isn't for me. Like I really notice that. I mean, I've so many faults in my leadership, but
I just wanted to add there that I had a previous principal, and he used to always say, take your work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. And I think that's really good advice in terms of, you know, really commit to what you do, but life's too short to kind of be too serious about things, and it's good to kind of, you know, laugh and when things are going well, but also when they're failures and setbacks.
Yeah. Do you think, Matthew, that you have balance?
Yeah, I do. I think generally I'm pretty balanced. Yeah. With that, I'd like a little bit more time on the weekends to work on my golf handicap and a few things like that. But I try and carve out a bit of time to keep the balance. Not always easy, particularly in teaching. I think it's true that teaching is a profession where it's easy to burn out, where lots of teachers do burn out. And because you're giving a lot throughout the day, every day, you need to give yourself a bit of time to kind of to nurture yourself and recharge.
We, at the beginning of this podcast, you're talking about teacher well-being and the importance of prioritizing what's important. Do you ever feel guilty doing something for yourself? I mean, the reason why I ask is we've got sort of two young kids, and we're kind of just getting to the point where our heads are above the water and we can breathe. But I've started going to the gym a lot more regularly, and I don't feel as bad as I used to. Can you relate in any way to that? When you're smacking a ball down the fairway, do you ever go, oh, I really should be prepping for that English lesson? Or yeah, a bit of advice on that.
Yeah, totally. I think it's age and stage of life. So my kids have just, they're finished school and now they're at uni. So, and so that dynamic sort of shifted a little bit in that space. And it can be easy, I think, to kind of think, oh, I've got all these other things that I should be doing. But in terms of well-being, you know, there's a lot that shows that if you do take a little bit of time out for whatever it is you're passionate about, whether it's sport or whether it's some sort of recreational activity or just stopping and doing nothing, that actually it's a lot better for you in the long run. So I'm practicing being better at that a little bit each day.
And so just a little bit of advice. I feel like quite often these podcast episodes are counseling sessions for me. What are some practical things that you do at the end of the day to switch off? I mean, one of the things I've been trying to do is put my phone on the sideboard as soon as I walk in and not look at it. But are there any sort of tips that you can give our audience about how to switch off and how to be present?
Yep. I'm a bit of a list maker. So I find that before I leave, if I can get that list, it's a bit, helps me to empty my head a bit so I don't have to carry it around. I like, yeah, like you, I, with my phone, I try and switch it off or don't go to the work part after a certain time, generally, to try and separate those two spaces.
Do you have emails on your phone?
I actually have a work phone and a home phone. Okay, so I actually switch off my work phone at a certain time. And that's my separation with the two. And I try and really stick to it to not to kind of go back to it. I think the third space that you mentioned earlier, the reset is really important. So basically, yeah, when you finish work, when you're driving home or on the bus home or walking home or however you get, try and empty your head, clear that space. So when you get home, for your, you know, your friends or your family to be really present and invested in that moment, and not kind of allowing, say, if you had a terrible year eight class at the end of the day, don't take that home with you. Try and leave it behind as much as you can. Easier said than done, but it's a good principle, I think, to practice.
Yeah, it definitely is easier said than done, and I think I have to ask for forgiveness from my loved ones multiple times of the day. Because like you mentioned, this job, regardless of what sector you're in, can be all-encompassing. And what we don't need is more passionate educators to burn out and go to another industry. I think it's really important to keep the very best and the very brightest in our school systems. And I had the privilege of running a number of marathons, and I think the lessons that I have learnt from that are things like perseverance, one step in front of the other, take your time, look after yourself. And there's so many lessons I think that are applicable to teaching. I know the amount of times I've had a shocker, and it's just about next day show up with a smile, because that's all you got. I think that idea of continuing to show up with a great attitude, smile, engage with your parents, engage with your staff, is hugely important. I mean, have there ever been times in your career where you felt, Jesus, is too much, I'm going to go work for Telstra or something?
Definitely.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, no, sorry, I Telstra, think that's...
I think the first few years of teaching are incredibly hard because you're generating everything from zero. And I really noticed that with early career teachers, and incredibly sympathetic, because it's like any kind of craft. The more experience that you get it, the more there's a sense of doing things automatically or intuitively or with a lot more flow. Whereas when you're first starting teaching, you're really kind of starting with an empty cupboard, and you're trying to kind of build up a bit of a, you know, a grab bag of things that kind of work effectively in the classroom. So I thought that was pretty hard those first few years. Sometimes I think starting at a new workplace is also really challenging. I always find the kids really energizing. I've worked in lots of different kinds of schools, and I just think kids are human beings, and it's just about, you know, really working on the relationships with them. And if you do that well, then I think the other things kind of take care of themselves. You know, I have great memories from when I was a prac teacher, you know, different classes right through to last year. Do you know what I mean? Finishing with the year 12 class. So for me, I could get a lot of energy from students.
Yeah, yeah. It is a really challenging job. But like I said, coming back to what we were talking about before, it's an incredible privilege, and I'm reminded every day of the privilege of our profession, because there are plenty of other things that we could do for better pay, but the fact that we choose and we get the opportunity to invest into the lives of young people and build them into, or help lead them into responsible citizens, I think is a privilege like no other. Matthew, I've just got a couple more questions. I do want to be respectful of your time, and I know that ironically we're talking about balance and well-being at almost 9:30 on a school night. Talk to me a little bit about, do you have any self-reflective practices or anything that you do that helps you redefine your leadership? Are you a journaler? Are you a writer? Are there questions that you ask yourself to improve that practice?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a note taker. So periodically kind of go back over those.
Yeah.
I think it's really important I often use the breaks as a bit of a reset, refresh. I always come back, I think, at the start of the year, particularly brimming with millions of ideas, because I've had some time to think. And that's one of the really big challenges, I think, of teaching, is that it's such a frenetic kind of occupation that you don't have a lot of time to stop and think. I have tried building just a little bit of time into my calendar each day to a little bit of reflective practice in terms of what's been working or what hasn't. Post-it notes I find work well too.
Yeah, absolutely. Matthew, I was just wondering, Shore has an incredible tradition, an incredible legacy and heritage of just doing education well for a really long time. Not all of us have access to those incredible opportunities. And I would just love you to share. I mean, there are teachers that work in contexts which are vastly different and also quite similar to your context. But what would be some of the takeaways that we could learn from what you're doing at Shore in terms of how we can better do professional learning? That was a really long-winded question. But what are some of the things that you're doing at Shore that we could all learn from?
Yeah, I think first thing is investing in it, because I think sometimes there's a tendency to think that it doesn't matter, or we don't have time, or we're all too busy. Yeah. So I think prioritizing professional learning, committing to the importance of professional learning, making sure that it's research-based. So when I spoke earlier around what we call the STEP program, the Shore Teacher Expertise Program, it's based on research. We've been fortunate that we can have a partnership with some academics from UNSW to help us on that journey. But even if you don't, you can still access the research and use that as a really strong base. Building a culture of collaboration, I think that's vital. Giving people time to come together, to valuing one another's ideas.
Yeah.
And then also just turning up the dial a lot and making sure that there's lots of information that's shared about professional learning, and having targeted kind of aspects that teachers are working on. So part of that program that I mentioned is that each teacher is setting a goal and working towards achieving that goal. So doing some goal setting as well is really important as part of that process.
Yeah, that's really important. And I'm assuming that Is the STEP framework available for sort of public viewing? Is it something that, are there any sort of cornerstone research pieces that we can share?
It will be. It's a work in progress. So we're at the stage where we're rolling out our first sprint. We'll do another one a little bit later in the year, and there will be some publications and presentations and things that definitely emerge as part of that kind of that research process.
Matthew, final question. I do want to, I'm so grateful that you would speak to me tonight. Do you have any advice for, if I was sitting down with you, we're about to have a flat white, I was a brand new teacher, what advice would you give me on how to love my career in 5 years' time as a new teacher?
The advice I would give is just be really passionate about what you do and value what you do as well. I think if you really commit and show up each day to the students and show that they're interested and put in your best effort, then you're going to get a lot out of it. But amazing. what you give back, you get back double, I think, in terms of from the kids and from your colleagues.
Yeah. And if I was same scenario, but I'm someone who's just about to step into a school leadership position, would there be any advice that you would be willing to share with me?
Yeah, certainly. Listen, ask a lot of questions would be the two things that I think I'd be focusing on. And something that I focused on last year when I came back to Shore, I did a lot of listening and a lot of asking of questions about why we do things the way we do, or what we do, and a range of aspects in that area.
Fantastic. Matthew Bentley, it has been an absolute privilege just to get to talk to you and just to share your teaching journey and the amazing work that you're involved in at Shore. So I can't thank you enough for your time, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of the week. I really appreciate you chatting to me.
Thanks so much, Matt. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed the conversation tonight.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the podcast episode today. It's a privilege to get to share these conversations with you and continue to invest into our incredible profession. If you have a few moments, please do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or through whichever platform you're listening today. If you wouldn't mind also hitting the subscribe button and sharing it with your networks, it would really help to get the word out to as many educators as possible. There are different ways to connect in the notes below, including links to the website, the Facebook group, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you again for taking the time to listen. It means the world.